I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Last night, Stephen Colbert ended the Colbert Report after 9 years and 1,447 episodes, much to the chagrin of the Colbert Nation, myself included. Dressed in a sharp-looking three-piece suit, Colbert addressed his TV audience.
Folks, if this is your first time tuning into the Colbert Report, I have some terrible news. This, in fact, is your last time tuning into the Colbert Report until, no. Folks, until 10 years from now when they reboot it, directed by J.J. Abrams. Man, I am going to wreck some with one of those new lightsabers. Now,
what time?
Now, because I am a transformational historical figure, that is, I have been on TV. Many of the thinkerati out there are asking what my legacy is. Well, ultimately, I believe history will be my judge. So I'm going to tell history what to say. And that brings us to tonight's word.
After giving Prescott Pharmaceuticals another plug, spoiler alert, Colbert shot and killed Grimmie the Grim Reaper and became immortal. Surrounded by many of the guests who had appeared on the show, including Doris Kearns Goodwin, Neil deGrasse Tyson, Henry Kissinger, Andrew Sullivan, General Odierno, and Andy Cohen, they all sang We'll Meet Again until Colbert flew into the skies with Santa Claus, Abraham Lincoln, and Alex Trebek. Few performers have made narcissists so funny and so much fun. Today on Radio Times, celebrating the Colbert Report, and we have three guests who have joined us, including Sherilyn Johnson. She's a blogger, a journalist, a diehard Colbert fan, founder and writer for Third Beat, where she writes about comedy, also co-author of Bears and Balls, The Colbert Report, A to Z. Sherilyn Johnson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here.
Also with us, Sarah Gray, and she's assistant editor at Salon, where she focuses on innovation. She's been posting the Colbert Countdown for Salon and been posting the morning clip for the site since 2012. Sarah Gray, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well. And we will try to get Sarah Gray up and running. Let me get Andy Greenwald in on the conversation. He's a staff writer for Grantland. He writes about TV, movies, and music, and he hosts the Andy Greenwald podcast for the site. And Andy Greenwald, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well. So Sherilyn Johnson, I guess we're all part of the thinkerati because we're all dissecting 9 years of the Colbert Report. Are you in some kind of degree of mourning this morning?
Slightly. I'm, you know, very satisfied with how great the finale was. So I'm somewhat elated for that reason. It is definitely hard to let it go. It's going to be hard to get used to in January when we realize it's not coming back. But I feel good about how it ended.
Do you feel good about how it ended, Sarah?
I do. Yes, I feel great about how it ended. I won't lie. When watching, I did get a little teared up.
You did? Just yes. Thinking that you won't be able to watch this character in the show again?
Yeah, it was just such a nostalgic moment to see all the past guests and to know that we won't have this character, bringing us such subversive comedy was just really was a little bit emotional.
I'm going to go back to you, Sherilyn Johnson. And, I was thinking about, and I don't know what the answer to this is, has there ever been a TV show that has gotten the kind of glowing tributes that the Colbert Report has gotten over the last couple of days? I mean, it's here we are kind of piling on, but it's kind of extraordinary.
Yeah, I really feel like not since Johnny Carson left, I think, has there been such an outpouring of love. And honestly, even as a diehard fan of the show and its greatest cheerleader, it surprised even me how extensive and how deep everybody's love for it is and just the appreciation that's been all over the internet the last few days. It's been really overwhelming, and I can only imagine what it's like for him.
Okay, let me take, looks like Tim calling us from Allentown. And Tim, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Well, first of all, it's kind of funny that these technical things are happening, especially amidst the Sony issue.
Funny for you, Tim, not so funny for us. We spent a lot of time putting this show together. But anyway,
I'm sure you work very hard, and I listen all the time. But, Stephen Colbert, I think, is one of the greatest satirists and most widely well-received, even among some of his detractors, since Mark Twain. And it's going to be really sad to to not see that anymore and to not not hear that.
And Tim, were you an early on enthusiast, or were you someone that?
Oh, absolutely. I started watching The Daily Show, and then when Stephen got his own show, I'm like, oh, we'll see how this goes. And it's like, oh, wow, I'm no longer watching The Daily Show as often.
Oh. Well, you know, it's interesting, and hopefully when we get our guests back, we can talk about this. But some have, you know, been sort of forced to choose, well, which one do you like, Jon Stewart or Stephen Colbert? I think it's an unfair question, but I'm going to put it to you, Tim.
When I wanted to go see one or the other, all of my friends didn't want to go with me to The Daily Show, and I didn't understand why not. But so I guess in order to keep friends, I had to side with Colbert.
Looks like we have Andy Greenwald joining us. Is that right? Okay, staff writer for Grantland, writes about TV, movie, and music. And Andy Greenwald, that's not exactly how we wanted to begin the show today. And welcome to Radio Times. Welcome to live radio.
Thank you. It's exciting to be here.
Yeah, isn't it? It's exciting for you. All right. Well, we're going to hang on to you and keep talking some more. I didn't have a chance to put this to you. I put it to our other two guests, which is And you're a little bit more of an outsider than the Colbert Nation, of which I am a member. But how do you see Stephen Colbert and what he was able to do for 9 years?
What really struck me when I was trying to take stock of this incredible run that he had was this really probably was the most impressive and unique sustained comedic performance, certainly in TV history, maybe in television history. I keep thinking about the length of Saturday Night Live sketches or the roles that, you know, that traditional TV hosts play, in which they're really the straight men, and I unfortunately mean that in all senses, playing
sure.
off of the sort of the lunacy around them. As I wrote in a piece for Grantland yesterday, Stephen Colbert was at once the inmate and the director of the mental asylum. I mean, he was doing this at such a high level with the most incredible, impeccable instincts, and he did it every night. We took it for granted, I have to say.
Well, and I think it is this sort of both parody, but also this level of performance. And as I said just a couple of minutes ago, I also thought he was a really excellent interviewer.
That's the thing that I think he is perhaps the most underappreciated talent that he had in his arsenal. It's one thing for an improv performer to master a character and perform the character. It's another thing to be as generous with that character as he was, because you know, the rest of the show, he went off book, but the rest of the show was scripted. The interview every night was essentially performing without a net,
right,
and actually getting information from his guests while performing this role, as you said and as he said, as a high-status idiot. It's really incredible.
I've interviewed a number of people that have been on the Colbert Report, and I always ask them, so what was it like? And they all described basically before going on the air that he would come backstage and say, look, just be yourself. I'm an idiot, and we'll sort of take it from there. But always felt very sort of welcomed and in on the joke, obviously.
Yeah, this is the other thing. There's a generosity to the performance, and I think it goes to the root of improvisational comedy, where everything is yes and. How can we take this to the next level? How can I take what you're giving me and improve upon it? It's never oppositional in that way. And that was my experience as well. I interviewed him 5 years ago, and he's a very warm and sincere person who really reaches out to you, you know, from across the table, even when the cameras aren't on. And so it's no surprise to me at all that he was that way with his guests, because to walk out on the tightrope with him, you have to trust him.
Well, we're almost up at a break here, Andy, but what I also appreciate and I hope he can sustain is just the diversity of his guest list.
Yeah, that would be the real question going forward. I think that his abilities as a performer and, as you mentioned, an interviewer, in some ways can only be enhanced by the freedom that he'll have on CBS. My only concern is I would just hate to see him use those talents only on the same celebrity on movie junket promotional tour interviews that everyone else does. He's so quick and he's so insightful on so many topics.
Well, let's take a very short break. Andy, don't go away. don't leave us, okay? Andy Greenwald, and he's a staff writer for Grantland, writes about TV, movies, and music, and joins us as we talk about Stephen Colbert and what he was able to do for 9 years. And again, we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Mosco, and we are looking back over 9 years of the Colbert Report. Stephen Colbert basically put it all to bed last night, and I do want to play a montage we put together. This is several moments from the show where Colbert spoofed NPR and its listeners. Let's listen.
Tonight, is public radio destroying America?
I'll tell you all about it in a quiet monotone.
NPR is cutting its staff by 10%. So enjoy this week's edition of Wait, Wait, Don't Fire Me. This is the Colbert Report. Now, unfortunately for multitaskers like me, I heard some very disturbing news recently on the NPR. Actually, like everybody else, I was half listening and half cutting up vegetables for soup. Something can finally be done to lift the painful burden of racism once and for all. It comes from a story I heard on NPR. Now, I know, but I was driving a rental and the knob was torn off. In the past, this section of the SAT has been accused of racial bias in its questions. For example, here's an actual analogy students were asked to complete. Runner is to marathon, and the answer was, as oarsman is to regatta. It was the most racially biased question since, when I drive my Volvo to buy Dave Matthews tickets, I am listening to NPR's All Things Blank.
Oh, I'm going to miss that show. Let me reintroduce our three guests who are back, fingers crossed here. And again, Sherilyn Johnson is a blogger, journalist, a diehard Colbert fan, founder and writer of Third Beat, and co-author of Bears and Balls, The Colbert Report A to Z. Sherilyn, nice to have you, I think, back with us on Radio Times.
It's nice to hopefully be back with you.
Hopefully as well. Sarah Gray, assistant editor at Salon, and she has been posting the Colbert Countdown for Salon and posting morning clips for the site since 2012. Sarah Gray, are you there?
I am here.
Excellent. And Andy Greenwald, staff writer for Grantland, are you still there?
I'm happily still here.
Very good. Sarah, let me go to you. And I think that that clip that we just played just shows how, not just the humor, but the good-natured humor that Colbert displayed on his show. Can you talk a bit about that?
Well, Stephen Colbert, I mean, I think that one of the best things about him is that he was always able to keep that, you know, blowhard egomaniac like persona, but it was always like in that good-natured spirit. It was always like keeping that comedic tone, and And that's what was so great and subversive about it, is that you could be saying something so completely terrible, but you could be keeping it and really skewering it by keeping it good-hearted like that. So that's one of the things that I always loved about it and will miss.
Sherilyn, I know you spend a little time, I guess, sort of behind the scenes at the Colbert Report. What is he like off the air?
I've met him a few times, and he is very lovely and just a warm, really decent guy. You know, just like Andy described earlier, he is very kind and really goes above and beyond to make a connection with you. I don't have enough nice things to say about him.
Really?
He is very kind, and I think that that decency is what really came through the character. He could get away with saying all of these things on the air that were ridiculous and ill-informed and sometimes even kind of cruel in some way, but he always had that decency behind him, and he's often talked about how at Second City he learned how to wear his characters as lightly as a cap, and I think he did that with his character, and people were able to see that there was a real decency and joy in his performance that came through underneath.
And Andy, going back to you, and then I do want to play a clip that was on many people's favorites, having to do with his run for his campaign run. Andy, if you want, could talk just sort of a bit about the level of writing on the show.
Sure. I mean, the writing on the show was generally note perfect, and it was obsessed over and sweated over. And it should be noted that you know, unlike some other hosts who just have their names on the writing staff, Colbert was intimately involved with almost every script. I saw it firsthand just how closely he was involved in it. You know, the writers who cut their teeth on this show have gone on to some of the more prominent jobs in Hollywood and writing for sitcoms. And Alison Silverman, who was his head writer for many years, now went on to work for The Office and Modern Family. The writing, I think Colbert would say himself, is where the show originated and where all the credit probably deserves to go.
In fact, Sherilyn, you won a chance to go to a writing seminar?
Well, I actually took a 6-week course with his now executive producer, Tom Purcell, who viewers will know as the guy in the audience who got shot in the leg last night.
Oh,
on the finale.
Yes.
It's a recurring bit with him. But Tom offered a course in New York back in 2008. And I was sort of a burgeoning comedy writer at that point, and took that with him. And it was called Writing for the Colbert Report. And you know, I learned firsthand how really, really tough that writing is. It is tough, and what they accomplished every night for 9 years is just phenomenal.
And how big was the writing team?
Their writing team fluctuated, I think, anywhere from 12 to 16, wow, somewhere around there, depending on how they were staffed.
Well, I do want to play this clip, and it's almost 2 minutes here, but it's from November 12, 2012. This was during the run-up to the 2012 presidential campaign, in which Colbert formed his own super PAC. He used Trevor Potter, the actual former commissioner and former chairman of the Federal Election Commission, the founder and president of Campaign Legal Center, and used him as the Colbert super PAC lawyer. And this is an episode describing a 501 C4. Let's listen.
So how do I get me one, Trevor?
Well, lawyers often form Delaware corporations, which we call shell corporations, that just sit there until they're needed.
So there's some anonymous shell corporation?
Right. And I happen to have one here in my briefcase.
Let's see it.
So,
okay, what's it called?
It's called Anonymous Shell Corporation.
That's got a real ring to it, Trev.
Registered in Delaware.
Now, I don't have to go to Delaware, do I?
No, it's already been done for you.
Okay. Okay, Anonymous Shell Corporation filed in Delaware. Okay, I got this. So now I have a C4?
Right. Now we need to turn it into your shell corporation, your anonymous one. So this says that you are the sole director of the corporation.
I am.
And that you are now electing yourself president, secretary, and treasurer.
Sounds like a great board.
And you are authorizing the corporation to file the papers with the IRS in May 2013.
So I could get money for my C4, use that for political purposes, and nobody knows anything about it till 6 months after the election.
That's right. And even then, they won't know who your donors are.
That's my kind of campaign finance restriction. Okay, so now I've signed it. I have a C4?
You have a C4. It's up and going.
Can I take this C4 money and then donate it to my super PAC?
You can.
Well, wait. Super PACs are transparent.
Right.
And the C4 is secret.
Mm-hmm.
So I can take secret donations of my C4 and give it to my supposedly transparent super PAC.
And it'll say given by your C4.
What is the difference between that and money laundering?
It's hard to say.
Well, what a public service announcement that was. Sarah Gray, your reaction to that segment.
That segment and that whole series about the super PAC, so incredible. I mean, won a Peabody Award for educating people about super PACs and about campaign finance. So, I mean, right there in this tiny 2-minute clip of comedy, you're learning about everything from C4s to super PACs to basically the way that shell corporations, you know, and the C4s funnel money into campaigns. I mean, it's truly incredible what he was able to do.
Especially Andy with that sort of naive outrage about the whole thing.
Right. His character is able to go up to the button that says do not press and just press it and say, oops, did I do that? And it's sort of an incredible way to actually do journalism. I think a lot of people have talked about how one of the main things that the Colbert Report did was puncture the sort of self-appointed gas bags that had been dominating the political debate. But that same gas has another effect, I think, in terms of political coverage, in terms of obscuring everything and sort of just agreeing to go along with these systems that maybe aren't that well understood or maybe not very well explained. He was able to push all that aside, swat all that cast away, and really reveal what's going on in a way that, you know, as I said, I don't know if a real journalist would be able to do it, or B, would certainly be able to get the audience for it that he did.
Well, and Sherilyn, a number of people said that they actually got their actual news from the Colbert Report, and I was a pretty faithful watcher, and I always felt like the more you knew, the more you got what they were actually doing on the show.
I agree. I think you're way better off to arrive at the show somewhat informed already. You won't get all of the jokes, and certainly, you know, he's spoken about how the style of how he delivers the jokes is also so heavily influenced by how the news media delivers their information. So I think it's definitely a romantic narrative of people getting their news from it. I'm sure some do, but I don't think those people are particularly that, you know, well informed at the end of the day. You get information from the setup to the joke, but you don't get all the information. So it's certainly a valid assessment on some level, but yeah, definitely way more enjoyable if you understand the news going into it.
We're getting some email comments here. The Colbert Show, The Daily Show kept me informed and sane during the Bush presidency, which I found so difficult to endure. It's interesting, Andy, because he, meaning, of course, Stephen Colbert, played a conservative, but a conservative that obviously used satire to express his liberal leanings.
Yes. I mean, the one thing that's always important to remember about Colbert himself and as a performer is that there is a bloodline of sincerity running underneath everything he does. I think he actually does have a lot of strong positive feelings about this country and about the rule of law and about the government and political process, but he's also not naive. And the character was not only extremely naive, but just desperately obsequious towards power. And so I think that allowed him to target things from both ends of the spectrum, basically, to be able to function so well during the Bush years and then transition almost seamlessly. I mean, the majority of his run was during the Obama presidency, and his attitude, you know, just gave him richer targets to poke at.
And we are talking about Stephen Colbert, looking back over 9 years of the show, playing some excerpts as well, and again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. It looks like we can take some emails at radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Sarah, do you have a favorite show?
A favorite show?
A favorite episode, sorry, yes.
I would certainly say that my favorite segment has to be actually pretty recent, 2013, when he did the segment on the Vico, Kentucky mayor. And that was just such an incredible segment. I remember when it came out, there were, you know, news organizations bombastically calling it maybe the best segment ever. And even a year later, I tend to agree with it just because it really just showed a really great and changing attitude in the United States. And also, I think it was a really great use of his comedy, where he got to play this, like, extremely ignorant, willfully ignorant, and, you know, just not a great guy. And then you get to see actual people be his foil and counteract him on that. And you get to see a small town mayor enact like the first non-discrimination ordinance of that size for that size of town. So I thought that was really incredible.
How about for you, Sherilyn?
I'm going to go, for favorite segment, I'm going to go with the response to cancel Colbert back in April, where the Twitter activists took the Redskins segment that he did the wrong way and called for the cancellation of the show. He came back on the air and did a whole bit basically explaining in a very multi-layered, it was a very difficult piece of writing, the fact that his work was satire without overtly saying it, because he can't step out of character and say, hey, this is satire.
Right.
He did so, you know, graciously, and it was really funny, and it made his point, and it ticked all the boxes and accomplished everything he could hope to accomplish in that response. So I thought that was really brilliant.
Do you have a favorite segment, Andy?
I'm going to go back a little bit to, it might not be my favorite, but it's the part I'm still most impressed by with the show, is when he took the entire Colbert Report to Iraq and filmed three or four shows there in blistering heat from a military camp. And, you know, I said before that he's out on the tightrope. This was dancing ballet on the tightrope, because he is there in front of troops whom he legitimately supports, basically lately jabbing the mission and their, you know, and their whole reason for being there. He did an entire bit in front of a raucous group of soldiers talking about the don't ask, don't tell policy, and it went over incredibly well. It took an enormous amount of bravery to perform that bit, but it also took an enormous amount of decency to bring his show to troops who desperately needed the entertainment.
Let me play an excerpt of one of my favorites. This is his interview with children's author Maurice Sendak. It aired, actually it was at Sendak's house, and it aired January 2012. Let's give that a listen.
Grim Colberry Tales with Maurice Sendak.
Mr. Sendak, thank you so much for talking to me today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Now, tell me about children's literature. Don't you think that by writing books for children, you're sending children the message that reading is important?
Very much so.
Okay.
Yes.
Let's talk about kids. I don't trust them.
Is that true?
They are just biding their time until we're gone, and then they get our stuff.
That's really
good.
And
they take our place.
Uh-huh. It's an interesting point of view.
Thank you.
But not interesting to me particularly. There is something in this country that is so opposed to understanding the complexity of children. It's quite amazing.
But what do you mean the complexity of children? Because children have it easy. They get driven every place. We feed them. We dress them. Newt Gingrich said it. Children don't have a work ethic.
But Newt Gingrich is an idiot of great renown. I'll give him that.
He's a historian.
Yes, but there is something so hopelessly gross and vile about him that it's hard to take him seriously, so let's not take him seriously.
Well, let's agree to disagree.
Sure.
Oh, okay. My goodness gracious. Andy, your thoughts about that?
I'm just continually amazed by his quickness. You know, everything there, he had no way of knowing what exactly Maurice Sendak would say at any moment, but he's such a trained and brilliant comedian that he knows when good comedy is happening and when an even better interview is happening, and it takes a certain kind of speed and wit, but also, I think I've said this word more than any other, graciousness, to allow his guest to determine the direction of the interview and then basically surf the whole thing like a wave.
And we're almost up in a break here, but Sherilyn, you know, and I watched it again last night. I mean, there is a kind of sweetness to that interview that's really quite adorable, I have to say.
Yeah, it is really sweet, and he does also talk about, you know, dialing up the character and dialing down the character as needed, and he does take really good care of his guests. That's something, if you really watch what he is saying to his guests, and he is actually trying to help them make their point, and so that is something that I think speaks to his character as a person, not to his character. So yeah, that does come through.
Stephen Colbert. Let's take a very short break and get back to our conversation. And we are talking about Stephen Colbert, the end of the Colbert Report. That's Sherilyn Johnson. Also with us, Sarah Gray and Andy Greenwald. And you can join our conversation. Phone number 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email. Send us a Twitter, radiotimes@whyy.org, @whyyradiotimes. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Sherilyn Johnson, co-author of a book called Bears and Balls, The Colbert Report A to Z. Sarah Gray, assistant editor at Salon, and has been posting the Colbert Countdown and posting morning clips from the show for the site since 2012. And with Andy Greenwald, he's a staff writer for Grantland. He writes about TV, movies, and music. He hosts the Andy Greenwald podcast for the site. And again, we are talking about the Colbert Report and Stephen Colbert, the I guess the character, and also the man behind the character. Andy, I do want to play a clip from when he spoke at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, but I just want to talk about it first before even setting it up, because, you know, that's not an easy thing to do, to lampoon people, very powerful people that are sitting right next to you on the dais. Was that an important segment, you think, for him to do?
I think, in retrospect, his performance at that correspondence dinner may end up being the definitive comedy act of his lifetime. I still can't believe it actually happened. It gets stranger in retrospect and more courageous and more brilliant. I mean, that's the other thing about it, is that it's incredibly, incredibly funny, which is an important reminder that he always considered himself a comedian first and foremost. He was never out to score political points as his main goal. But again, it wasn't just the tone and the voice and the ego of the Bill O'Reillys and Sean Hannitys of the world that Colbert was out to mock. He was really out to mock their complete obsequiousness towards power. Mm. And here he was, next to the most powerful man in the world, doing just mocking him just to his face. It was pretty remarkable.
Well, and Sherilyn, it was funny, but no one in that room was laughing.
Well, according to him, people in the back were laughing. The front row and the dais were not, and they are the ones who are mic'd. So according to him, it sounded really good in the room. But to us with the C-SPAN feed, not so much. But, you know, one of the great things about Colbert as a performer is his commitment. He'll commit to anything. So even if it didn't sound great in the room, he would go full steam ahead and not relent.
Well, let me play just an excerpt, and then Sarah, I'll get you in on the conversation. Again, this is Stephen Colbert in character at the White House Correspondents' Dinner in 2006, and he is, as you'll hear, delivering a pretty biting criticism of the president, who was sitting just a few feet away from him. Let's listen.
Most of all, I believe in this president. I stand by this man. I stand by this man because he stands for things. Not only for things, he stands on things. Things like aircraft carriers and rubble and recently flooded city squares. And that sends a strong message that no matter what happens to America, she will always rebound with the most powerfully staged photo ops in the world.
Wow. Sarah, you want to weigh in on that?
So I watched that speech. I was say like half a dozen times in the last week, because it is just, I agree with Andy, it gets better and funnier and more subversive every single time you listen. And I just loved it so much that he brought the concept of truthiness, which sort of launched him that first show, to the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Like, he is saying it to all these people in power about, you know, feeling it from your gut, and even using some of the same lines, that you have more nerve endings in your gut than in your head. And and it's really interesting to hear that he actually got laughs in the back, because I rewatching it again for the first time recently, during the final part of that speech, when he does the audition to be the press secretary, and Helen is following him, there were no laughs. It was dead. And I just couldn't believe the commitment to that, to you know, lampooning these powerful figures right in front of them.
Edward emailed us saying, Monday through Thursdays was the best hour of TV ever, worth losing sleep over. I'm glad and grateful that I share my time on this planet with Jon Stewart and with Stephen Colbert. Also, Stephen at home loved the Better Know a District segment, especially his 09 interview with Delaware Representative Mike Castle. And we haven't really talked about Better Know a District. Do you want to weigh in on that, Sherilyn? And another way, perhaps a public service that came from the Colbert report, a way of understanding districts from his unique perspective.
Sure. Well, Better Know a District was born almost by accident, just out of necessity. They were having a hard time booking people on the show at the beginning. And so, you know, his booker, Emily Lazar, came to him and said, well, the only people that will talk to you are members of Congress. And he's like, well, great, let's make a thing out of that. And those were really, really fun pieces. They would go out in the field like he had back on The Daily Show and do segments in that style. And, you know, he had some great, great conversations with people that, you know, they were almost always game to play along. He did the most ridiculous things, from, you know, he was combing one congressman's mustache and leg wrestling another one and skateboarding with another. And they're absolutely absurd things. But it was great in its ridiculousness.
And Andy asking a lot of hostile questions on top of that.
I think it's always worth remembering that the Stephen Colbert character was poking fun at a certain kind of blind patriotism, but he was never actually making fun of the country. I think that that's a really important distinction to consider, because from his perch in New York City, Stephen Colbert was very, the man, I guess, and the character, was very open about his genuine love of things like minor league hockey, you know, or the man himself is a Sunday school teacher. He has what some people would term, you know, these sort of old-fashioned traditional American values, and I think going out into the country allowed him a chance to both push and prod and poke in the way that he did, but also kind of celebrate things in an unironic way that I think was, and I think that's one of the secrets to the show's success.
The unironic way that he used parody and satire.
Yeah, in a way, and a sort of a celebration on the bottom, somewhere underneath all of the jokes and the raised eyebrows.
Well, and he also loved fast food, or at least he did, at least the character Stephen Colbert seemed to love fast food.
Loves fast food. I seem to genuinely love selling out as much as possible and getting his face on ice cream cone flavors and whatever else he could. And I think that, you know, like any good comedian, celebrating the ridiculous is part of your job.
What do you think, Sarah Lynn, I'm interested from all three of you, what do you think he's going to be able to do, or who do you think he will be when he's the real Stephen Colbert? And this, I think, Sunday is when he takes over his new gig on CBS.
Well, when he takes over, he's obviously not going to be the character. I've had the privilege of watching him perform out of character, essentially, many times. You know, I went to 13 tapings of The Rapport, and he'll come out of character and answer questions and be very funny and engaging as that. I've seen him do other live events as himself, and he is so sharp and fun and engaging, and I think people will be very pleasantly surprised how that translates when he isn't filtering it through a character.
And what do you think, Sarah?
Well, he's an incredible performer. So I think that even without the character, he's still going to bring that fun comedy and maybe a little bit more of the improv. You know, the Colbert Report was, I was listening to an interview, and it was, you know, scripted. The argument was scripted down to a T. Wow. And the only time he was really able to improv was with the guests. And here he's going to have, I think, probably a lot more time to interact with the audience. I think it's going to be really interesting also because there are some parts of Stephen Colbert and the character that overlap the love of Lord of the Rings and Star Wars and the fandom. And I hope the interesting guests translate, you know, the scientists, the authors translate into The Late Show.
Well, let me pick up on that, Andy, and let me go to you. You covered TV, and can you imagine the same kind of guests that were on the Colbert Report being on his show, CBS?
No.
In a word, no.
Maybe eventually, and certainly maybe in the second or third slot. But it is going to be fascinating to watch because just on the, you know, CBS is in many ways the most cautious and stable of the major broadcast networks. And, in you know, if you think about it from that side of things, getting Stephen Colbert was very smart because he's such a known commodity and such a popular figure and such a competent and himself stable figure. On the other hand, they're pouring tens of millions of dollars into someone who we really haven't seen on TV on a regular basis, the real Stephen Colbert, not the character. So it's going to be fascinating to see. I think he'll be able to do it with aplomb because, as we've all been saying throughout this segment, he was so good in the interviews because what he was in those interviews was a gracious and generous host. And that's essentially what a late-night talk show host needs to be. So I think that is the spirit that he'll bring to the show. But I think everyone in the industry, and I imagine a lot of people who have grown very comfortable to watching David Letterman, will be tuning in with great curiosity to see.
Well, Andy, I don't know the audience, the CBS audience at that time of night. I'm assuming it's a lot older than the Comedy Central audience?
That's exactly right. The CBS audience, the late-night audience in general, is much older on the broadcast networks than it is on Comedy Central. That said, it's kind of a if there's any safe place to be on TV, it's probably on CBS. They have, as I said, they have very stable viewership. And Jimmy Fallon on The Tonight Show has made such a huge splash and has gotten such incredibly consistent and incredibly high ratings that it's almost not expected of Colbert to beat him, at least in the short term.
That's interesting.
I think that what he has to do is keep the lights on, stay afloat, and then, you know, a few months in, maybe a year, and then we'll see where we are. But I think that he's actually launching at a fairly safe time.
Paul has a question. He's talking about last night's Colbert. He says, please explain last night's last scene. You've got Abraham Lincoln, Santa Claus, Alex Trebek, and Stephen Colbert all going off into the skies. Sherilyn, what's your take on that?
It was ridiculous.
Very good.
I think it ends there.
Just plain old ridiculous. How about for you, Sarah?
It was pretty ridiculous, and I also love the moment of, saying like, oh my goodness, it's the most all-knowing person I know. And I was sort of expecting it to be a religious figure, and then it was Alex Trebek, and that just like was the best punchline. It was just so great. So, I would agree. It was just ridiculous and wonderful.
Ridiculous and wonderful. And Andy, do you have another adjective?
Well, I thought it was a very delicate balance. I actually was expecting a little bit more sentiment in the evening, and I guess there was some in the song. But I also was realizing that what Stephen Colbert was doing was essentially phasing from one part of his career into another. Many people thought when they saw the guest was the Grim Reaper that he would be killing the character, but he didn't want anything so final. He didn't want it to seem like he was dying or retiring. It was just sort of pressing pause on one part of his career with the hopes that this audience might follow him wherever he may go next, whether it's to CBS or traveling on a reindeer sleigh with unicorn Abraham Lincoln.
Amy sent us an email. She says, thinking of Stephen Colbert makes me want to cry. Words cannot express the spectacular impact he's had on this nation and on mankind as a whole. Those are big words. Sherilyn, and it's interesting, does anyone have anything bad to say about Stephen Colbert?
Oh, wow. Well, I'm sure a lot of Republicans do. a lot of people don't like his style of comedy or his targets. But, you know, honestly, the outpouring of love this week that we've seen, it's really overwhelming and people seem to really, really love mm-hmm. him.
Yeah. I'm also just sort of curious about what Larry Wilmore, and he's going to be taking over this slot, I think, in January. And if I can go back to you, Andy, I don't envy him, I have to say.
Yeah, it's a tough spot. And I think one of the reasons why Jon Stewart and the bosses of Comedy Central picked Larry Wilmore is because he is a veteran writer and performer himself. So he's not likely to wilt under the glare of expectation. I think it's being made very clear going in, hopefully to the audience, certainly internally, that they are not trying to replace Colbert with anything at all like Colbert. I think he's going to bring a very, very different energy. And actually, long-term for the network, it's an energy that might be a little bit more complementary to the evening. Mm-hmm. Because now, you know, even the name, the Larry Wilmore show was announced that it was going to be called The Minority Report. It's now The Nightly Show. So now Comedy Central has this neat block of The Daily Show, The Nightly Show, and Midnight that sort of all slots together. I think that Larry Wilmore is an incredibly talented, very sly comedian. I think that it's going to be a very worthwhile and interesting show. But hopefully people can use the holidays and afterwards to cleanse all Colbert imaginings from their minds, because it's not going to be anything like that.
And Sarah, I think we do need to give a shout out to Jon Stewart. I mean, you think of, besides Stephen Colbert, John Oliver, Samantha Bee, Jessica Williams, Asif Manvi, Larry Wilmore. I mean, he has begat a lot of people.
He has. He was actually asked about that on Howard Stern maybe like a month and a half ago. And he just seems so happy to do it. You know, Steve Carell at Helm, these are other people that he sort of launched as well. And I think he's getting ready to launch Jessica Williams. She's incredible. So I think that there's just like a lot of goodwill. So I think that, I mean, he finds such amazing talent, or the talent just sort of comes to him. I'm really impressed with what the Comedy Central has been able to do, and all these people that have been able to come out of this.
And the last question to you, and just a thought, we haven't really talked about his musical abilities, all the musicians that he had on the show and those that he performed with as well, but the guy can sing and dance.
I think this is where the CBS gig starts to make a lot more sense. I mean, he is a traditional all-around performer, as you said. I mean, he sang last night. He has a wonderful voice. There's a video clip going around online today of him singing with President Obama last week when they were trying to get the melody right, and he's coaching the president on his vocal inflections. I think one thing to look for in the CBS show and his new version of The Late Show will be that, you know, he actually can compete with Fallon in that sense, in that he is ready to sing and dance and do anything at all to entertain the audience and actually be really good at all those things, too. I think he's looking forward to the freedom, and I'm excited to see him have the chance to try it all out.
Well, my thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Andy Greenwald, thanks so much.
No, thank you.
And he's a staff writer for Grantland. Sherilyn Johnson, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Co-author of Bears and Balls, The Colbert Report, A to Z. And Sarah Gray, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
Assistant editor at Salon. Well, we do want to close things out with another clip from Colbert. Colbert had thought that Daft Punk was going to join him in the summer of 2013. When they pulled out of the appearance, he lampooned the situation and danced around the studio joyously. I'm Marty Moscoen. Let's give it a listen.
The legend of the phoenix, huh. All ends with beginnings. What keeps the planet spinning? The force from the beginning.